This week on The Other Side Australia, the evils of capitalism, why socialism is the answer to all our troubles, and why the rich must be taxed and made to suffer. Just kidding. We all know socialism is the ideology that kills. 100 million plus people in the 20th century, in fact, murdered by their own governments in its name. But why does this bad idea never die out? Why does such a horrible ideology live on and on and on in the face of all the evidence to the contrary? And why is it rearing its ugly head again in modern Western societies? The answer is envy. The lies of socialism are very seductive, especially to the young and poorly educated. And the state of our school system in Australia and most of the Western world these days sadly means we have no shortage of young, poorly educated kids. Add a diet of trash TV, social media, and a shallow consumer society of entitlement and victimhood, and you've got a recipe for disaster. This week, for our last show of the year, we're going to take a deep dive on how to combat the myth of socialism with some hard truths about free markets, liberalism, and capitalism that you won't learn in an Australian high school or university. G'day Melbourne, Sydney, Brisbane, Perth, Adelaide, Darwin, Hobart, Wollongong, Newcastle, Geelong, Ipswich, everybody in Australia. This is the final episode for 2023 of The Other Side Australia, episode 235, for the weekend commencing Friday night, December the 8th, 2023. I'm Damien Khoury, welcome. Well, last week on the show, we showed you an interview on The Project, my favourite TV show, with one example, sadly not a rare example, of the product of the modern Australian school system. A 16-year-old girl who just marched in a school walkout strike protest for Palestine. Or was it climate change? Anyway, it doesn't really matter. She just had this to say, like she was the first kid in 100 years to ever think or say these things.
How can we, you know, sit back and just let this all happen? I mean, as a socialist, I want to fight for every single person who is oppressed by this horrible capitalist system.
You talk about your opposition to capitalism. Does this mean you'd be protesting things more broadly, that we would see you starting to protest all kinds of things that you think are connected with capitalism and missing school for those things as well?
Well, absolutely. I mean, look back, just last week I was at the climate strike on Friday. I've been reading this sort of stuff for years. And it's not just about what you read, it's about what you do with that knowledge and how you utilise it. So we've all come together, masses of students, passionate and powerful. We are saying no to funding Israel's genocide to Palestine.
It's adorable, really. She will grow up, hopefully, but many like her do not. They keep on thinking this way right into adulthood, and then they become teachers themselves and teach other kids the same garbage.
I've learned more organising this strike in the past month than I have in 2 years of modern history at school, which is really saying something.
It sure is. Things are bad in Australia, but the rest of the Western world has the same problem. No doubt our young friend would be very pleased with the news from earlier this year that the teachers' union, not a student union, the teachers' union in the American state of Colorado, the Colorado Education Association, officially rejected capitalism as an economic system. Wow. Not kidding. Here's how America's Fox News reported that.
The Colorado Teachers Union taking aim at capitalism, rejecting it as an economic system and passing this resolution that says, quote, capitalism inherently exploits children, public schools, land, labor, and resources. Capitalism is in opposition to fully addressing systemic racism, climate change, patriarchy, education, inequality, and income inequality.
Wow. And I thought we had problems here in Australia with the leftist infiltration of our education systems. That is pure madness, and it ignores so many of the truths about capitalism that it's not funny. More on that in a moment. But Americans aren't like us. They have a strong conservative base, and they're not taking this lying down. A local Colorado school district board leader, David Ellingsworth, told Fox he was shocked by the union's statement.
It was just pretty stunning to see the biggest teachers union in the state of Colorado openly adopt a radical anti-American resolution like that and be really open about it.
Point blank, if they oppose capitalism like this, doesn't it follow that they are actively promoting communism?
Oh, it's always communism when the rubber meets the road. You know, you can call it Marxism, socialism, but when they start actually putting it into practice and implementing it and all the misery and ugliness that comes with it, it's communism, no doubt about it. Since the COVID times, there's been a great awakening of parents to what's really been going on in our schools. And that's happening in Colorado. That's happening all over the nation. And these people always want to say, no, it's not happening. But here you have it. The mask has come off. In Colorado, this union thinks they're too big to fail. They don't think they have to hide their anti-American radical political agenda any longer. And they're determined to push it not just on the government and the people, but on their kids.
Folks, it's time we all started learning and teaching about the system that we take for granted. Capitalism and liberal free market democracy. I thought it might be appropriate to begin our final show for the year with a look at what we as grown-ups should be saying to kids who've bought into the socialist lie and think capitalism is inherently bad. This is a very important question, because if we don't start to loudly and proudly support capitalism and free market liberal democracy, we will lose it. And as the middle-aged uncles or aunts at the Christmas or Hanukkah dinner table that the young people like to mock and ridicule, we need to get ready with our responses and do our job as adults in raising these kids right. They need to be applauded for their interest and their caring, but they also need to be respectfully challenged. And we, the elders of Australia, need to stop trying to be cool and fit in with the kids, and instead step up and do the work of parenting our country's young people properly. For help in this, I turn to a very smart man called Jeffrey Tucker. He's an American writer, publisher, entrepreneur, and libertarian. He has an Aussie connection. He's a research affiliate at the Blockchain Innovation Hub of the Royal Melbourne Institute of Technology. Jeffrey Tucker worked with the American Institute for Economic Research and organized efforts against COVID-19 restrictions, and he founded the Brownstone Institute think tank in 2021, which we spoke about in depth a couple of episodes ago on this show. Well, many years ago, Jeffrey Tucker gave a speech in which he outlined the fact that we in the West take a lot for granted, and we simply don't recognize or even see the benefits of capitalism. A bit like a fish who doesn't realize how much it's benefiting from the water it's surrounded by. And we just take it for granted until it's gone. And since the 1960s, kids in the West have had negative ideas about capitalism and a love of socialism. It's cool to reject the dominant paradigm and be countercultural, but they used to grow out of it eventually. What's happening today is that kids are not growing out of it. They're turning into the academics and teachers, the journalists and media producers, the entrepreneurs, the HR managers who influence hiring in our corporations, bureaucrats who run our governments, politicians, clergy, everyone. And they're passing it on across generations. Our only hope is that because left-wing thinking is becoming the dominant paradigm, that the kids will get sick of it and realize they've been sucked in by the establishment. And we'll see a good old healthy countercultural revolution to swing back to ideas of liberalism. Supporting capitalism and free market liberalism could now be cool and edgy. Capitalism and classical liberalism are the new black, the new woker than woke, the new rebellious ideas, the new counterculture. But we need to speed this process along. We need to get back to basics and remind people loud and clear of the huge benefit and the huge freedoms that capitalism brings.
So this is a chart of income per person throughout history. Starts in 1000 BC and goes all the way up to here, and it's completely flat. Completely flat. Nothing ever happened. No progress really to speak of. And then in about 1800, we see income per person shoots up and it goes up to the very top of that chart. Just like that. So isn't it wonderful that you were born like over in this tiny little corner of life instead of any other time over here? I mean, that's kind of fortunate. You didn't really do anything, did you, to deserve that? I mean, you didn't make that choice, did you? It just sort of happened to you and to all of us in this room. So if you ever feel like you don't have anything to be thankful for, just sit down like that man with a good conscience in the story and say your prayers of thanks for the fact that you're born now instead of at any other time. If this was like a random thing, you just kind of threw your life down on this chart somewhere, most likely you wouldn't land here, but you did. So good for you and congratulations. That's a wonderful thing.
Yep, it is a wonderful thing, and we should give thanks for it every single day. But how did it happen? What caused that incredible spike in human productivity? Was it socialism? No, it was not.
My iPhone, my iPad, my everything we're surrounded by. The achievements of civilization are all around us. And are we asking ourselves where they come from? Who built it? Are we staying up at night to observe what happens? And that's what economics is all about. It's about the desire to be curious about where all this stuff came from. We should know. We shouldn't just take it for granted.
Right. Mr. Tucker says there are a number of reasons we have all this wealth. The first being the right of individuals to own stuff and to have those ownership rights protected. Why is that important? So that they know that if they invest their money or they work on those things they own, their property, and make them grow, that they will be able to keep the fruits of their labor, their thinking, and their effort, and their risk-taking. It's a little principle at the heart of free market liberal capitalism, and it's called
private property. Private property is the beginning of civilization, it's the beginning of prosperity, without which there can be nothing at all of any note that will ever advance our lives in any respect.
Without private property ownership rights, nobody would bother doing anything very much to advance themselves. Because why put the effort in if you can't keep the fruits of your labor? And so most people didn't do much for thousands of years. Advances were only made by those allowed to own private property, the aristocracy and the elites. But when private property rights were made available to everyone under capitalism and free market liberalism, kaboom! Prosperity. So the idea that you'd want to take things and have them collectively owned by the government to force some kind of equality of outcome, it's insane.
And it's sheer nonsense to say that everything should be owned by everybody. That really makes no sense at all. And I don't understand how it is that this idea of socialism ever got off the ground. I mean, the first person who came up with socialism should have just been laughed at and said, well, that's preposterous. Why don't you go back to your dreamland? And that would have been it, right? I mean, that idea should have been killed, you know, about 5,000 years ago or something. I mean, but anyway, the idea is still around.
It sure is. Socialism persists like a bad virus that just keeps on coming back and will not die out. Maybe because envy is such a powerful human emotion that people cannot stand it when other people seem to have more stuff than them, even if it's only temporarily and even if everyone is getting richer in the process. Jeffrey Tucker says the second most important reason that history turned and the massive wealth spike happened was an idea called the division of labor.
You can prove this mathematically, and I wished I had time to do it. But here's the point, that even if you're kind of like shabby at virtually everything you do, there's still a place for you within the division of labor. Even if somebody else you know is amazing at doing things, a million different things, he simply does not have time to do all those things in the course of a day. So he must have assistance. And if you cooperate, people of low skills and people of high skills cooperate, then both parties are better off in the end. And you can absolutely prove this. And this is the magic of the division of labor, is that it finds a place for every single human soul in the great productive enterprise of global economics.
So we have the right to private property and the division of labor. Big changes in human history that created significant wealth. But the real magic comes from the third big shift that happened, the right to freely exchange goods and services, the right to trade with one another freely. That is a massive invisible hand, as economists like to call it, the invisible magic of huge wealth creation, which socialists, like our little 16-year-old friend on the project, would happily destroy tomorrow if they could in their foolish ignorance.
An exchange is a mutual gift giving, and that happens every time you're engaged in any commercial activity. And I can give you my most recent example. Actually, last night at 10 o'clock, I went into Taco Bell with $1.99 in my pocket. And I looked up at that menu and I thought, is there anything in this menu that's worth to me more than what I have in my pocket? So I said to the lady, I said, listen, I have $1.99 in my pocket, but and it's worth a lot to me in many ways, but your Enchirito is worth even more to me than what I own. What about you? What's your sense? Is your Enchirito worth, I know it's worth a lot to you, but do you think that my money might actually be worth even more than your Enchirito? And she said to me, you know, I'm so glad you brought up this point because it is in fact worth more to me than my Enchirito. And I said, well, why don't we just exchange? And that way you will get a gift of my money, which is worth more than your Enchirito, and I will get a gift, which is your Enchirito, which is worth more than my money. And she said, that is a beautiful idea. And we exchanged with each other. I handed her the money, and she handed me this little plastic tray of mushy, you know, beans with, and we looked in each other's eyes, and I said to her, thank you. And she said to me, no, thank you. And it was wonderful. And we were so happy afterwards, so much happier than we were before.
Merry Christmas. And that, my friends, is the beauty of free choice and free exchange. You don't need a government in the middle of that transaction taking its 10% of GST or regulating everything to within an inch of your life to suck all the joy out of that magic. And that is the definition of free market liberal capitalism.
If you could repeat this a trillion times in the course of an hour all across the world, what would happen? What would happen? The world would be a very beautiful place. And that is, in fact, what is happening all the time. And that is the source of our happiness.
So there you have it. That's why we're rich. The right to own private property, the free division of labor, and the miracle of free exchange and trade. But if we listen to our socialist friends who want everything to be equal all the time and throughout all time, we would all be broke. It'd be equal, all right. Equally disastrous. Just ask Argentina and watch last week's episode of The Other Side. Yet we listen to these kids on TV and their teachers and the Greens and we think, oh, gee, socialism sounds so nice and kind and compassionate and it's about fairness, but it's anything but. It relies on force and violence and government, not freedom and happiness to work. And that is why it is evil. That speech that we just watched from Jeffrey Tucker was called Surrounded by the Achievements of Capitalism. It was delivered 12 years ago. But you can search it up online by its title, Surrounded by the Achievements of Capitalism by Jeffrey Tucker. Now, how hard was that story to tell? That's all we've got to teach kids about economics at school, but we don't. We fill their heads with a sense of entitlement and a sense of grievance with some sick narrative, which is totally false, about oppressors and oppression, day in and day out. And if we don't stop doing that, we're going to destroy this very rich little miraculous period in history that we've created, a period which has seen the greatest alleviation of poverty, the greatest extension of lifespans, the greatest improvement in health and quality of life for more people than ever across the world in the entirety of human history. So if anyone says to you this Christmas that capitalism is evil, tell them this story. And maybe, just maybe, they might listen. And if not right away, then at least you'll have sown a tiny seed of doubt. And one day, in the future, they'll remember and thank you for it. Merry Christmas. Well, if you're a teacher and you're tired of your union fees being used to indirectly support left-wing political parties and causes, and you'd like more of your union fees spent on you and the services that support you and the services that you need, there is an alternative to the traditional state teachers' unions. Red Union is an organisation founded to provide such alternative industrial and professional support, and they've got a special teachers' union called the Teachers Professional Association. And it's really gaining in popularity. And joining me in the studio is the secretary of the Queensland branch of the TPAQ, the Teachers Professional Association, Edward Schuller. Edward,
thanks,
thank you very much for coming on in.
Thanks for having me on, Dave.
Appreciate the time at this time of year. I know it's pretty busy.
Absolutely.
Tell us a little bit, first of all. We did have Graham Haycroft, the founder of the Red Union, on the show, The Other Side Interviews, earlier in the year. But just to recap, what is Red Union? It's not really as the name would suggest. You're a bit more of a classical liberal-leaning kind of professional association.
Yeah, well, we're all about providing workers protection without the politics. So yeah. We represent and go into bat for tens of thousands of workers across Australia now. So nurses, teachers, police officers, independent workers across all of that. Obviously, like you mentioned, I'm the Secretary of the Teachers here in Queensland. So we're basically an alternative to the QTU and the IEU up here. And there's certainly a market for it. There's certainly a need for it. We just go about our business providing, workplace support. We get involved in EBAs, yep. Legal advice, can also help with professional development, all of that sort of thing. So we do provide the full array of services.
But you're focused on the things that a union should be doing.
Exactly, union right. business. You're doing proper things that our members want us to do, not going out and seeking political agendas or anything like that. So I suppose the major difference, though, is the price. We are essentially half the price of the QTU and the IEU. And like I said, the major reason we're able to do that is because we're not politically involved. We don't give money to the ALP. We don't go out and campaign on political issues. We don't, put our resources into fighting social issues either. We're all about protecting teachers in Queensland.
You're spending the money on the stuff you should be doing, not spending it on...
So the resources go back into supporting our members. So if that's industrial disputes, whatever it might be, it goes back into supporting the members. And that's why we're able to be much more affordable.
So there's that much waste, right? In the
Yeah. The fundamental difference is we're not giving money to the Council of Trade Unions or the College of Trade Unions. And we're all about reinvesting our... members' money into them.
So you're growing, I understand. Not surprisingly, you're growing at a pretty rapid rate. How many members have you got in the teachers around Australia now?
Absolutely. Well, around Australia, we've got thousands across Australia, thousands here in Queensland as well, approaching 20,000 across the whole Red Union as well, which is, meaning that there is a market for it. Our existence is justified by people wanting to come across to us.
So 20,000... in all the unions. So you've got a nurses union, a medical association for doctors, yep. a teachers union, and a general workers union.
Yeah, right? There's an independent workers union as well. Wow. So we also provide protection for police officers as well. So basically every worker in Australia can get protection from us, and we'd encourage that, of course. But the nurses in Queensland are the biggest one out of the Red Union associations, and the teachers are the second largest. And we're growing by the day because the QTU and the IEU aren't changing their ways, and in fact, I think they're getting worse.
I want to have a chat to you about left-wing sort of ideology, because we were talking about that in the show, infiltrating the classroom. You're on the ground, you're talking to teachers. We've got a number of problems with education and teaching, obviously, in Australia. What's your take on what you're hearing from teachers about the stuff that they have to deal with? Because I guess you'd have a lot of teachers who are probably not left-wing, right, that don't want to be in the teachers' unions but want an association.
Yeah, absolutely. Or they just don't want politics shoved down their throat.
Yeah.
So there are obviously some more conservative-leaning that come to us as a union because they don't like what's being pushed in the QTU and the IEU. But I'd say the overwhelming majority are just hardworking teachers who want workplace support. And that's the extent of it, and that's what we're able to provide. But in terms of the things that are being taught in classrooms and pushed onto teachers, there's a lot of talk around teachers pushing onto students. But when you see what happens with the actual unions themselves, the amount of pressure that is put on teachers to be able to, we can talk about the recent stuff with the Israel-Palestine conflict. We can talk about The Voice, of course, and climate change. There's a number of different examples where it's the unions who are instigating so much of this.
Right. So how do they do that? Like, they're putting pressure on teachers indirectly or directly.
Mm. But so of course they've, I mean, you hear stories about potentially forceful delegates across Queensland and across the country. But it's also just the executives have so much power within these unions that they're able to push these things on to the delegates, to the secretaries, and then push it through the teachers. Yes, there are some teachers who, you know, have these beliefs and go about it. But I'd say there's an overwhelming push from these unions to pursue these political issues and campaign
so,
on them.
Okay, so the problem's worse than we thought. Like, I mean, it's not, I was curious as to whether this was a real thing or a phenomenon. I mean, I know that from my own kids at school that the curriculum is shifting or that they're getting a lot of extracurricular political commentary around stuff. And it's woven into the stuff that they're doing as well, right? But I didn't realise that there's actually this thing going on with the teachers themselves at a school. So you would have, like, what, a union rep at the school, and there'd be this kind of workplace pressure, if you like, or indirect workplace
100%,
pressure.
100%. And we've had many stories from QTU reps that have come over. Our treasurer is one of them. And the amount of pressure to do political work within schools, I mean, it's not a daily thing, but it certainly is pushed. And you can only look as far as the strikes that are currently going on, you know, endorsed by the AEU down in Victoria, which is the QTU equivalent up here. And the QTU aren't coming out and particularly denouncing when their members are out there purporting this stuff. So,
well, we just showed a sign, I think it was last week's show, of this you know, thing inviting teachers to come along and go to a teachers thing for Palestine, and it had location in your school, meaning, you know, we're gonna, it should be in your school that you're driving all of this stuff.
They're not trying to hide it, are they?
No. It's just extraordinary.
Yeah, and I mean, it's become particularly apparent over the past few months. Obviously off the back of the Voice campaign where they put so much of their money into the Yes vote and into campaigning and resources and all of that for the Yes vote. We had a position on the Voice. We didn't have one. Our position was very clear. We're not going to tell our members how to vote because this isn't union business.
It's got nothing to do with school business.
Exactly.
God, it's just crazy. Another thing I'm particularly concerned about is that there was recently this report from IPA, Bella De Brera did a fantastic study, I think, pulling together all of the stuff that universities are teaching kids, working out what our unis are actually teaching teachers.
Student teachers.
So what are our universities teaching these student teachers? And she found that it was like half of the subjects that are on offer, or more than half of the subjects that are on offer, were all had some link to gender theory or identity politics or woke theory or something of some kind, right? They were those sorts of subjects, you know, social science, waffly stuff. And there was very little focus on teaching teachers to teach numeracy and literacy, so that what's happening is we've got a problem with numeracy and literacy coming out the other end in terms of the teachers that we're getting.
Yeah, there's a number of, I'm glad that this issue around the curriculum and obviously teacher courses as well is coming up, because there was also a report released by the Grattan Institute of all places talking about the...
Yeah, that's a left-wing thing.
That's a left-wing thing, and it's talking about just how dire the situation is when it comes to sciences. So no surprise, we're about 70%, we're learning about 70% less. Our students are learning 70% less than a lot of students in, you know, comparable countries, comparable Western democracies, when it comes to biology, when it comes to other STEM fields as well. You know, they might be teaching climate science, but the actual basics aren't being taught in school. And it's no surprise that, you know, teachers are, you know, clutching at straws in the classroom because they potentially haven't been, you know, given the tools that they need to be able to teach properly.
Yeah.
And then that flows in. It's a big flow-on effect. I mean, there are so many issues. I would say the, you know, the sort of ideologies that are being pushed in schools is a big problem, but it is not the key problem. It is a symptom of a centralised system. So when you've got all of the decisions being made in capital cities for schools.
Right.
The Department of Education has become so bloated. Each state Department of Education, and the federal one, is quite useless as well. When you've got all these decisions being made on student discipline, on curriculum, whatever it is, on how it's taught, being made in capital cities.
Because it's not just curriculum, as you say, student discipline was also another thing that came out, how badly teachers are being trained in how to manage the classroom environment and keep control and that sort of thing and discipline. That's what they want, right?
Absolutely.
And
so
not
it's
getting that.
All these key issues are a symptom of this centralized system. So the teacher shortage, you know, when it comes to the ideologies being pushed in classrooms, the student discipline, all of that is a result of a centralized system.
Right. So it's capital city decision making being pumped out from the center. Mm. There's no
one size fits all. That
no
sort of
competition
stuff.
In the marketplace.
Yep.
No different people coming up with different innovations and ideas and having different schools that parents can send their kids to and all this sort of thing. It's all just being centrally pushed out, and they've tried to nationalise it even more. So Canberra becomes the capital city that it's coming out of, and we've seen how out of touch Canberra is,
exactly,
given the voice vote. But, yeah, I mean, this thing about one third of school students failing to meet the minimum standards for reading and writing and numeracy in the NAPLAN tests.
Yep.
And last week, two of Australia's most eminent scientists, we've got Nobel laureate and ANU Vice Chancellor Professor Brian Schmidt and the former Chief Scientist of Australia, Dr. Alan Finkel, both of them saying, look, we've got this terrible levels of literacy and numeracy among our school students. So decentralisation might be the answer to all of this, giving schools more power, having more. I know that I think it was Campbell Newman, wasn't it, that in Queensland introduced the idea of independent schools, so taking some state schools and letting them have more autonomy.
Yep.
Can we do more of that? And what are your thoughts on? I mean, some liberal economists have said to me, the way to do it, to actually get it to work, is to, instead of funding schools, you fund the parents. So you do school voucher,
Absolutely.
Education vouchers to parents, and then they choose the school they want and spend that voucher like money. I want to go send my kids this. So a school that has good teachers in it is going to get more. And
exactly.
Will that work? Is that possible?
It's part of the plan that we've got as well to go local.
Okay.
So that is, you know, running schools locally. So having parent elected boards with principal, three teacher reps, and three parents as well. So that's where a lot of these decisions can then be made. A lot of the administration can come back to local schools, so there's not pointless bureaucratic administration being done, which then goes...
Because teachers are drowning in the admin garbage, right?
We've run a survey of all our members as well, and it's come back very clearly that workload is the overwhelming issue that they face on a day-to-day basis. And that comes back to the paperwork that they're having to do.
It's not the teaching.
No.
It's not the academic workload.
No.
It's the garbage the government's asked them to do.
Absolutely. It comes back to that. And it also goes to, a number of different issues. But, it suggests that the big issue within the education system is that it is all centralised. So going local looks like running those schools locally, cutting useless bureaucrats, and then you're able to actually pay the teachers properly. So you hear all this kerfuffle around, certain EBs, and it's, there's been so many failed ones by the QTU recently, and it's talking about 2 or 3% pay rises. There needs to be a complete shift the way that the system is run, and you can have 20% pay rises for teachers. And it's not money coming out of thin air. It's putting bureaucrats who are trained in teaching and can actually teach back in the classroom, and it's telling the others, well, sorry, you're not required anymore. When schools are run locally, that is enabled. Expelling unruly students is another big one as well. The discipline issue in schools is one that is brought up with me on a daily basis. And obviously our fifth pillar of that Go Local plan is to be able to, reform the teaching degrees that we've just spoken about.
Yeah, so it's the university system, I suppose you want to cut it back a little bit, get it a little bit tighter. The courses are quite long and there's a heck of a lot of waffle and padding in there. And I find mature age people, I mean, I tried to get into doing a teaching degree. It's like now 2 years for a postgrad, and I wasn't even accepted on the basis of some of my professional capability.
Yep.
It was extraordinary.
You wouldn't think that there's a teacher shortage, would you?
No, you wouldn't think there was a teacher shortage. So many mature age people that would like to do it as a great way to impart their knowledge to kids later in life. But we're not. There's no pathway for that. It appears there's actually a wall being put up.
Yeah, and that's why I think we should have paid placement in these schools for learning teachers, because you can have that 1 to 2 years of content where you get up to date with everything that you need to be able to teach, but you're actually learning how to teach from experienced teachers in schools every day.
Yeah.
You're not being taught these abstract concepts by professors that haven't taught a day in their life.
It's brainwashing, and it's effectively just their own driving their own agenda and keeping their own jobs. Basically.
Absolutely, it's that, and it's just completely inefficient. We've got a teacher shortage crisis. Yes, these student teachers would need to be supervised, but it would allow for a lot of non-contact time for current teachers, and it would help address in some way the teacher shortage, and ultimately it would mean that they're a lot more prepared when they graduate.
Well, the libertarian and classical liberal kind of economist thinkers would say that the voucher system puts the power in the hands of where it should be, which is the client, which are the parents and the students, right? And it takes the power, and this is probably why the teachers' unions, the traditional teachers' unions and the Labor Party and everybody don't like it, because it takes the power away from the teachers. Mm. But in actual fact, it only takes the power away from the bad teachers. It doesn't take the power away from the good teachers, which is the other reason they don't like it, because they hate hierarchy. They hate the thought that a good teacher is going to get paid more and a bad teacher is going to get paid less.
Yeah.
They don't want that competition that the rest of us all have in business, right? Mm. Of having to perform. You've really got to, and then getting rewarded properly for your performance if you're a really great teacher.
Absolutely. And I think one of the things that the voucher system and many of our proposals for going local does provide, it's accountability. Because at the moment, there is just no one held accountable for. Everyone says there's a problem. Oh, there's a teacher shortage crisis. We have reports come out and say, our teachers are struggling. Our students aren't doing as well as they could be. It's very dire, but who's the buck stopping with?
Yeah.
It's currently no one, because it's also centralised and it's also faceless. If you bring it to a local level, teachers and principals are accountable at a local level. Good teachers, like you said, are more than happy to be held accountable for the way that they teach.
Let them teach.
Exactly.
Don't force them to do all this admin and
100%,
accounting back to the central authority.
Exactly.
Control education, control media, you control the culture. Mm. And that's what this is really all about, right?
It's about control.
It's a very serious part of the culture war, if you like, if we're going to get Australia back from the left. I love this. So there was a University of Canberra student, final year student, who told The Australian about his course that he was doing at uni, and there's a slide that one of the lecturers had about postmodernist writing, and the slide had a rambling, incomprehensible 92-word sentence, and I'm going to read it to you.
Please
do. It's this. The move from a structuralist account in which capital is understood to structure social relations in relatively homologous ways to a view of hegemony, in which power relations are subject to repetition, convergence, and rearticulation, brought the question of temporality into the thinking of structure and marked a shift from a form of theory that takes structural totalities as theoretical objects to one in which the insights into the contingent possibility of structure inaugurate a renewed conception of hegemony as bound up with the contingent sites and strategies of the rearticulation of power.
Beautifully put.
Isn't that great?
Imagine taking notes on that. And this is what it comes back to. That's one example. There would be thousands.
Yeah.
Taking notes on that in a class or trying to have to put up with that sort of thing, would you not prefer as a student teacher to be in a classroom getting prepared for when you graduate?
Yeah.
Be in a classroom, in an actual school, that is, not in a university hall.
I know you're politically neutral, but as a classical liberal, one of the great things about socialists is that nobody can actually understand them, I find. So it's very helpful for us.
Yes.
Anyway, so great to hear about that Go Local campaign. I think it's fantastic. And how do people join up with the TPAA?
Yeah, so you can just give us a call. Sign up's very easy, 5 to 10 minutes online if you wanted to. But if you've got any questions, obviously there's a lot of mud being slung in our direction because we are succeeding. So if you've got any questions, want any concerns, put it bay, give us a call. Always happy to have a chat and we can help get you on board.
So just Google it up, TPAA or TPAQ if you're in Queensland.
Yep. TPAQ.redunion.com.au.
Or just Red Union.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay. Awesome. Right. Edward, thanks so much for coming and talking to us on The Other Side of Australia. Perfect. Really appreciate it. We hope to have you back sometime.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me on, Dave.
Okay. Bye. A new report from the Sydney-based classical liberal think tank, the Centre for Independent Studies, is exploring the question of the politicisation of Australia's public service. Should politicians appoint the people they want to? There is a case for that, since we elect the politicians and we expect them to perform. And a big part of leadership is hiring the right people, at least it is in the private sector. You live and die as a CEO or managing director by the people you hire and fire and how good you are at building a great team. But should the public service be as independent as possible instead? It's a bit of a tough one, which is why I wanted to explore it, and there's nobody better to explore it with than my next guest. Dr. Scott Prasser says we have to get back to a more independent, merit-based system, and he's got some ideas about how to do that. Dr. Scott Prasser is a senior research fellow at the CIS and is the author of the Centre for Independent Studies report that we just mentioned. Scott's worked in federal and state governments in senior research and policy roles, and he's making his second appearance on our show. Dr. Prasser, great to have you back.
Great to be back.
On the other side. So tell us about this report. I mean, there is a bit of a, you know, conflicting, I guess, ideas here that, you know, you as leaders, you want our elected ministers, politicians and MPs to be making the decisions, not the bureaucracy. You don't want to create this underclass of a deep state bureaucracy. But you've also got to have a degree of independence, right, between the ministers and the political side of things and the bureaucracy to get the right advice.
Absolutely.
How do you reconcile those?
Well, look, ministers these days have very huge personal staff who they appoint. A federal cabinet minister has 15 to 20 staff.
Oh,
and
right.
That okay. They can have all the political advice they want from that group. But we've got to have a professional, independent public service, the people who know how things really work, who have memory and the files, and understand different topics really well, who can say to the minister, well, minister, that's a really dumb idea. Mm. If you want us to do it, we'll do it, but we're telling you right here and now, that's really not a good thing to do. The minister wants to do it, they will do what the minister wants. But we've got to get a system whereby the public service is professional, they're people who are appointed based on their skills and qualifications, not because they're somebody's mate, or they vote the right way, or they've got some particular sexual predilection to a particular viewpoint. We want to have people who know their job and are appointed for what they know, not about who they know.
Yeah, okay. So I guess I get that, but I also feel for the case that you've got to kind of, if you're running something, you only know a certain number of people. And if I ever became, you know, a political leader in management, I would always want to be able to appoint the people that I trust, that I've built relationships with throughout my career and my life, who I believe can do the job well and will have a degree of loyalty.
Mm. Well, look, what used to happen in the 19th century, the British public service was, you could buy a position in it. Okay, or you could buy a position in the army, you know, that's why we had the charge of the Light Brigade, all these sort of fools who were running the British Army sort of thing. You couldn't buy a position in the British Navy because you had to bring back the ship.
When you say buy a position, you mean I just fund something and then you'll get a position.
Look, Daddy, you know. Daddy wants me to have this position,
right.
A lovely uniform, and look, Daddy, I'm the youngest son of Lord such and such, and there's no really position for me, so we'll buy a commission in the army, right? And the public service was like that too. And so what they discovered, that let's have a public service appointed. They started bringing in examinations, right? You have to sit for an examination to get appointed.
Yep.
You have to have qualifications, and you work your way up the system based on your efforts, if you like. And if there's a change in government, we've got a continuing permanent public service who can continue to give advice to whoever is in office. Because politicians, as you know, are temporary office holders, okay? They come and they go. But the public service keeps the records. So it was a great reform in the mid-19th century, and that's what we brought to Australia. And we had a number of royal commissions in the 1890s, and we formed an independent public service, people appointed, sitting for exams, working their way up the system, knowing their areas back to front, okay? So when there was a change of government, they could say, look, Minister, here's the file. We did try that once before. Okay. Now, what's happened is that we want the public service to be responsive, and it really started the Whitlam Labor government in 1972. So Whitlam wanted to have the public service who were really partisan and supporting the Labor agenda. So they started appointing people on his personal staff to be departmental secretaries to run the departments. And that's when the rot really started. And then all parties now do that. So what happens when there's a change of government, federally or state, there's not just a change of who's the minister, there's a change of who's running the different government departments, right? And the problem with that, you bring in people from the outside, often limited experience, and they give the advice that the ministers want to hear, not the advice that the ministers need to hear. There's two different points going on.
I get that, but I also hear, you know, the flip side of that is, well, you know, we've elected a new government.
Yeah.
And if you don't, you end up with the British system, I guess, that they were mocking in Yes, Prime Minister all those years ago, that British fantastic TV series, where it's this deep state sort of, we're going to just tell the minister or manipulate the minister, and the public service just remains the same. And the people really running the country are the public servants. And I think we're in a situation in Australia now where, we have senior public servants have way too much power. The bureaucracy are running this country, and they're running it in the wrong direction.
I'm not sure about that.
But look,
under Menzies, he accepted some of the people he inherited from and we had Labor government for 8 years before Menzies got elected in 49. As a prime minister, and prime ministers have always had the power to decide who's going to be department secretaries, and if the minister doesn't get on with the department secretary could be moved to another position or role. And if they're incompetent, they do get moved out. Okay, so it wasn't like permanent forever, but it meant that public servants had a career structure. Now, what the Robodebt Royal Commission recently showed was the problem was having these people coming in and out, lateral recruitment all the time, that these people didn't know how the system worked. The old system, you worked your way up the system, okay? So you worked, joined as a clerk, you got in charge of the records, you went to the counter and so on, and so you knew how that worked. So I don't agree that the public service do run the things. I can tell you right here now, having worked in three federal cabinet ministers' office, the ministerial office runs the show.
Well, you know.
Okay,
yeah,
it really does.
Okay.
The power's shifted to the minister. But I want the public service, my relationship with the public service was, you're the professionals, I want you to tell me what you really think. Forget who you think I am or who I work for or what you think of the government policy. If you think this is a crap policy, I want to know about it. And I want to see that in the submission to the minister. I don't want the minister saying, no one told me about this problem. Okay?
Yeah.
So that's why you've got to have people appointed based on their competence and ability, not based on their political allegiance or their sons and daughters or boyfriend, girlfriend or whatever.
Yep.
Okay?
I get it.
Become.
My question to you would be, then how do we make sure we don't end up with a situation where you get a public service that's locked into a particular political mindset? Because at the moment in Australia, I do believe that our public service, state and federal, is culturally locked into a big government self-serving mindset or a big government and slightly left-wing identity politics mindset in these massive organisations.
But they get all their cues for that from the elected government of the day, right? Okay.
So you're saying that's coming from the political side.
Tell you right here now, in the 6 years I worked for three cabinet ministers, the public service did what they were told.
Okay, right? So you worked for Conservative side of government,
that's
right?
Okay, I worked for two education ministers and one regional health minister. So two Liberals and one National Party minister. And I can tell you right here and now, that the public service followed orders. There was never a leak, okay? But we had a very open discussion about issues, about what is your advice, okay? What's the best advice? But what's happened is that we've been changing the public service, and you see the new Albanese government been gradually changing departmental secretaries, okay, who's there. They're appointing people who are camp followers, okay? Right? And why you've got to have people who can trust, you want to have people who can tell you that's a bad idea. That's why we've got so
totally
many problems.
Yeah, yeah,
so
yeah. It's the same in the private sector, right? You've got to hire people who are going to challenge you, and you've got to give them, you've got to make your leadership team feel like they can challenge you. Mm. Otherwise, you will just get a bunch of yes people. Mm. And when you get a bunch of yes people, you go down the drain.
That's right.
Right? And you'll have all sorts of problems. I guess the thing that concerns me is, and a number of people have pointed this out, that under the Howard sort of era, we had public servants we had ministers, elected government ministers, who were in their ministerial portfolios for years.
Mm-hmm.
And then we had a situation where, now I think it's very rare to find a minister that stays in their portfolio for more than 2 years, or even 18 months, I think was touted as a long term. Okay, so then you need the layer underneath to be stable, but how can our elected representatives, the ministers, ever get their hands around a portfolio, their minds around a portfolio, and control of a department if they're not there long enough and if they don't have the power to hire and fire the people running the department?
Well, firstly, ministers have got to hire good staff, ministerial offices.
In the ministerial offices,
right?
Okay.
One of the problems of ministerial offices, and we, as the erupting events we see in court and so on, is there's too many young people. Too many young people with not any experience about how things run, okay? And so I would visit the department two or three times a day or a week, going down the department, parking spot, meet with people down the line, okay? Mm. The minister would go down there, the department would come all the way up. So you can run the department, but you've got to have a political agenda to tell the department what you want. All the things you complain about, the left has said, that's because we have all these quotas. The public service didn't invent the quotas. They're quotas that have been developed by the political parties that have gone along with these things. And the non-Labor side of politics has got to say no to those sort of things.
Well, Scott, I know that you know, in the public service, I mean, we've got 500,000 state, federal and local public servants in Queensland as just one example, right? And that's 10% of the state population. Yeah, just a few too many. Okay, so the public service by its very nature is, as an organisation, is going to continually expand itself and be self-expanding. That's acting in its self-interest. So nobody within the public service who puts their hand up and says, I think we should cut this department, or I think we could do this in half the time, is going to go anywhere in their public service career, right? So the only thing we've got is the political ministerial office and the minister to say, you're cutting, you know, we need to reduce this, we need to do it. And then if the minister takes that political line or has a liberal or classical liberal view of things and wants to make government smaller, they leak on them, or they'll give information to the opposition, or
you get sacked, they're breaking the law. Okay?
Right,
okay,
right,
simple
right,
as that. Okay,
right,
you leak, okay, you're out. Okay. Goodbye. Okay, leaking is against the law. Leaking cabinet documents is against the law. Leaking.
That can be done subtly. I mean,
I know that, but I think the issue is it's the political parties have got to have the will, and the policies to implement the policies that are needed, and I believe the public service has got to be done that. But the trouble now is that when there's a change, say there's a change in government in Queensland next year, right? Election. So the incoming, say there's a non-Labor government, is in power, they're going to say, all the people we've inherited are probably Labor appointees.
Well, they would be, right?
Okay, right? And they've been on contract and so on. Now, we'll bring in our people, right?
Right.
Okay, so we start again,
okay,
right? So we've got the Westminster system without the Washington checks and balances.
So just explain, okay, so the Westminster system is the British system, of course. It's supposed to be, as you said. Now, the Washminster system is, I bring my people in.
Every change of government is a change of the hierarchy,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, yeah.
And even a bit further down below the top ranks, okay?
Yeah.
So that causes all sorts of problems. People without experience, organisational memory, okay? Or people who are too willing to do the government's bidding, which is what the robo-debt thing was all about.
Right, okay.
And what did the Podger report to the Robo-Debt Royal Commission say? All the things people like me have been complaining about, we got rid of the public service board, we got rid of that insulation from political appointments, and public servants were too willing to do the government's bidding and not question what the government was, the legality of some of the things they wanted to do. So we've got the Westminster system without the checks and balance of Washington. And the checks and balance. In Washington, in the American Constitution, there's what is called the Senate confirmation process.
Yes, okay.
So I'm going to appoint you to the Supreme Court. I'm going to appoint you to the Department of Secretary. We better check you out. Have you, had any car accidents lately? All that sort of stuff,
Off you go
What drugs have you been on and so on?
Right.
And, okay, we think you're a good character. And you've got to front up to a Senate committee, okay, and get questioned.
Mm.
So we do quite a bit of checking on you. And although the government will get its way, if something really badly comes out about you, then you won't get appointed, right? Now, I think we can do something like that federally with a joint Senate House of Reps committee, okay? Just like we are doing with appointments to anti-corruption bodies. And nominations to senior positions should go through some sort of public transparent process.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yep. Sounds reasonable.
So, do you know the minister very well? Is it true that you've all been best friends since school or something or other? Those sort of questions. What's your commentary? What degrees do you get? How do you know this area? that would be, that should be, you know, publicly televised, and the government can still make the appointment, but that will bring a bit of checks and balance into what's going on in Canberra now and what will happen. So what will happen next year? What will the non-Labor government do? Will they do what Campbell Newman do, bring all these public servants from the Brisbane City Council and some other public servants in, who are Liberal Party people? That just creates another set of problems. I think they've got to sit down now. How are we going to put the genie back in the bottle and have a permanent public service? In the Joe Bjelke-Petersen era, which I know everyone criticised, we had a permanent public service. We had Leo Hilcher in charge of the Treasury. No, Premier, you can't have it. Right? You can't have a zoo. Right? Mm. Sid Schubert, the Coordinator General, was a professional engineer, and they would go in and talk to Joe and explain the things that were not going to happen. Right? So that stopped all the crazy things from happening. That's why Queensland was in the budget surplus, right? Unlike the Andrews government, which is not in a budget surplus, because the public service has just did the bidding of the government of the day. Oh. You've got to have this sort of slight insulation between the politicians who deal with the politics and the public servants who deal with the implementation of the policy.
But then who are the public servants accountable to? They're not accountable to the free market. But you're saying they're not accountable to the minister,
They're
right?
accountable to the minister, because the minister's going to have to answer the questions about what's going on. There are estimates committee processes that go on. You go and watch the Senate Estimates Committee and see the public servants being grilled. I've been with them for 12 hours. For 12 hours, okay? I believe what we've got to have, we've got to get back to having a professional, not politicised public servant. People appointed on their competency.
Yes.
Okay?
Yeah. And the problem is, how do you get that without the free market mechanism?
I think you've got to have a really independent body that does the appointments.
All right.
Okay? That's what I think you've
got to
start with.
You could also start with a smaller public service, maybe.
I agree. Look, more public servants, you're right. Just like the idea of having more parliamentarians. You know, the latest report, we want to increase the size of federal parliament. Danger, danger. More politicians means more sticky beaks wanting to do more things, interfering in our lives.
Please don't. Please stop doing
that. That's right. That's right.
I love talking to you, Scott, because you teach me stuff. I think you've actually, that's what the show's about, and I'm still certainly educated by that conversation. So thank you for addressing some of my misconceptions and helping us.
You're
to
on
get,
the right track. We just got
to
work out how to fix it.
You've got to get that balance right.
Mm,
yeah,
that's right.
It's incredibly difficult, but can be done. So hopefully it will be done.
Thank you.
Dr. Scott Prasser, thank you very much for joining us. And that's all we have time for this week and this year on The Other Side Australia. Please like and share and tell your friends about the show. It's really the best way that you can support us and help us keep the media landscape in Australia more diverse politically and have more diversity of opinion, the only diversity that should really matter. The other way you can help us is to keep on watching our content over the Christmas break. There is so much to catch up on. All of the 35 back episodes of The Other Side Australia from this year are up on adh.tv on any web browser. That's all you've got to do. adh.tv, no .com, nothing like that. And it will take you to our homepage, and all the shows are there for you. Not just my show, but everybody else as well. And all of our earlier interviews shows from earlier in the year, they're all there too, and our full-length interview with Dr. Prasser, as well as many other very, very interesting Australians. And you'll find all of our sister shows, Alan Jones, Fred Paul, Alexandra Marshall, Daisy Cousins, Spectator TV, Nick Cater and Professor David Flint and Dave Pello. You can download our app to your phone. Just search up ADH TV on Google Play in the Apple App Store, or watch our live stream on YouTube at any time, or download the app on your smart TV at adh.tv. Just search that up. Only Samsung, I think, is the one that doesn't work on, but every other television you can do it. There are heaps and heaps of ways to find our content, and lots of content to enjoy over the holiday break. So from all of us here at The Other Side, director Aaron Lucas, Jesse, John, Matt, Jorge, and David in our Brisbane team, all the gang at ADH TV, Sydney, with Charles and Jack and Martina and everyone, have a wonderful, happy, holy and heartwarming, very Merry Christmas, or Happy Hanukkah, or Bodhi Day, whatever you're celebrating, or just Happy Holidays, as the woke kids like to say. And we'll see you again very soon. Bye for now. Thank you.